perhaps I might make a start for this event. Hi, my name is Tanya Penovich. I'm a Deputy Director at the Kasdan Centre for Human Rights Law, and I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Now, before we start with our speaker, Robin Dekrepny, I'd like to introduce Justice Susan Kenny from the Federal Court of Australia, who's going to be giving an award to one of our future leaders, law student Chris Barney. Now, I might just briefly say a word about the Honourable Justice Susan Kenny, because she herself is a leader and a trailblazer in many respects. She is a Federal Court Justice, but was the first female Justice of the Court of Appeal in Victoria. She, as a barrister, was on a team in the Tasmanian Dams case, along with Ron Kasdan. And her illustrious career includes a gig on the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission as a commissioner, now called the Australian Human Rights Commission. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the Honourable Justice Susan Kenny.
Thanks, Tanya, very much indeed. The Future Justice Medal, which is what I'm about to award, is awarded to young professionals for their leadership and initiative in promoting future justice. The organisation, if I can give it that, or the body, Future Justice, takes as its starting point the UNESCO Declaration on Responsibilities of Present Generations Towards Future Generations. And whilst it's committed to advancing the interests of present generations, future justice is at the same time committed to securing and strengthening the life chances of future generations. This year's most deserving recipient of the Future Justice Medal is Mr. Christopher Barney, who I hope is in the audience. Excellent. Hi, Chris. He's the Child and Youth Advisor, Indigenous Programs at World Vision. Christopher Barney is a committed youth advocate dedicated to supporting the voices of marginalised and vulnerable young people. His youth leadership has led to many places, and in particular he was appointed in 2009 as the Australian Youth Representative to the United Nations. Chris is also a storyteller, and as the 2009 Youth Representative he engaged 2,000 youth in national listening tour, during which he created the Dear Kevin book, which some of you may know, and played a significant role in having a juvenile detention centre replaced. When he came back from the UN, and I won't tell you so much about that, that's a very interesting saga, but when he came back, Chris implemented the first report back tour to honour the trust that young people had placed in him, and his efforts were recognised by the then UN Secretary General. Aside from this, Chris speaks widely on disability rights and the need to stop children being defined through labels. Since Chris has himself Asperger's syndrome, he's able to speak on these matters with particular force. And with Future Justice, I am especially grateful that he's taken this path, since it's, in my experience at least, labelling children in this way deprives everyone, both now and in the future, of talents we can ill afford to lose. Chris has a longish history with World Vision, which he joined at 15, I understand. He's done a lot with World Vision. He served on Vision Generation, including as Victorian State Director and National Coordinator. And as I have said, he's currently Technical Advisor, Child and Youth Participation with the Indigenous and Pacific Programs Team. He's also, I understand, on the Steering Committee of the National Child Rights NGO Task Force. Aside from all this, which I find extraordinary in itself, he is, as you've heard, completing a law course. Unsurprisingly, he's already been the recipient of numerous awards, including in 2012, he received the National Award for Youth in Advancing the Legal Rights and Interests of Children and Young People, and this university recognised him in 2011 as their Student Alumni Award. It therefore gives me great delight and satisfaction, Chris, if you come forward, to award him.
Thank you very much, Justice King. This is just enormously humbling. I've had a year and a half of getting a lot of recognition and attention, and I certainly have a lot to earn. I firstly just wanted to really acknowledge Dr. Paula Gerber, the Deputy Director of the Casson Centre for Human Rights Law, who I worked with very briefly this year at a children's rights symposium, and afterwards just received an email saying she'd like to nominate me for these different awards, which was very humbling, and she's really just a beautiful human being who wants to support every human rights advocate out there. And if you look at her background on so many different issues, I really feel like I have a great example to work with and a lot to earn. I have some very special people here tonight who I wanted to thank, who've been a great example for me. And it's funny, when you receive an award, there's a lot of people behind you who are actually the people that have earned the award through the investment they've made in you. So I wanted to acknowledge them, my best mate Anthony, my sister Marion, my grandma, who to her 40 grandchildren is known as Nan, and my mum, who've just been terrific. As Justice Kenny said, when I was young, I was diagnosed with what's known as Asperger's syndrome, an autism spectrum disorder. One of the things that I really picked up when I was youth ambassador to the UN was a frustration that kids out there who are given a label that might describe any disorder or disability sometimes grow up feeling very burdened and with a perception that they can't do things. And for me, the childhood I received from my family and my network of friends was always one that was very empowering, and it raised me without the burden of a label. So when I was a young person, I guess what was inflamed within me was a belief that no child should be defined by a label, and that they could always turn what might seem to be their greatest disadvantage into their greatest advantage. That in disability sometimes we're given gifts, and that when you operate in a different way, as kids with Asperger's and autism do, if you find the right channels for that, you can achieve extraordinary things. I certainly don't want to hold myself up, but I've been very lucky for the channels I've been given in World Vision and Human Rights to find things that play to my strengths and that helped me to broaden when, as a kid, I was quite narrow. So thank you very much for the investment you've made in me. This will certainly help me with the work that I do on anti-discrimination, and I hope to really earn it. Thank you.
Now, after that very inspiring beginning indeed, I'd like to introduce Robin de Crepney, our speaker. Robin is the author of Ali Al-Janabi, The People Smuggler, and I won't read her bio to you because I assume you've all read it since you're here. But I might just mention that The People Smuggler won the Best Non-Fiction Award at the Queensland Literary Awards last month, and it's just been announced that it's now a finalist for the Walkley Book Award, as well as the Waverley Library Nib Award and the 25th Human Rights Award for Literature. So please join me in welcoming Robin de Crepney.
Thank you very much. Does this one work? I think I can move around a bit. The book, The People Smuggler, it was never written as a political book at all. It was written about an extraordinary man. You're such an inspiration, Christopher. Thank you. it was written about an extraordinary man who lived an extraordinary life. And but because he was a refugee and took that journey that so many people took, that his story has in many ways become a political book, just in that it is starting to reach people in a way that helps them find out what it is really like, and to put themselves in the shoes of someone going through this experience and begin to ask themselves, what would I do if I was in that situation? And also to start to see this is not black and white, as we are being persuaded to believe by what we're reading in the press and hearing from our parliament and our politicians. The idea came to me originally as a film. My background is a filmmaker, and I began to write it as a script. It was brought to me by a group of advocates who were trying to get Ali out of detention and to get him a permanent visa after he'd done his jail term for being a people smuggler. I'm not really giving the end of the book away, because I think a lot of people know this, because his story was in the press a lot during that period. It went to federal the federal court, and it continued to be pursued for many years. So it was brought to me by the advocates who thought to themselves, discussed the idea, the only way they could get the minister of the day, and at that stage his application could only be responded to by the minister, who had been through all the formal process of the immigration department, and now was in the hands of the minister to give him clemency and give him permanent residency. And it was refused 3 times by 3 different ministers, including Chris Bowen, who is now the minister. This is back in 2008. He had been in detention for 2 years, and they came to me and said, if only people could hear this man's story and know who this man was, they would be happy and glad to have him as a member of our society, and maybe the label people smoke might disintegrate. I didn't like to tell them that it often takes 10 years to get a film up, and even then, you know, you might only get it distributed for a week and it'll disappear again. I embarked on it with great enthusiasm. But as I progressed with the process of getting to know Ali, and of course, you know, because we've been brought up on seeing people smugglers as these incredibly evil people, with labels from our politicians like heinous criminals and scum of the earth that you're robbing jail, and the worst possible human beings, the vilest human beings that have existed. It's very hard for us to imagine what sort of person they're talking about. So when I met Ali, I was very impressed. He's a man with a very strong sense of morality, a very strong sense of responsibility. He had a great feeling for life, with a wonderful sense of humour, and a great love of his family. And the other thing that really surprised me was he had a real insight into his own behaviour. He had a tremendous sense of self-awareness that I really wasn't expecting from someone from his culture. Did I say Ali was an Iraqi refugee? Did I say that? Perhaps I didn't. Okay, so we're talking about an Iraqi here. And just as a little sketch of the book, Ali became a people smuggler to help his family to safety, to get his family to safety, but ultimately came to be seen when he was tried in his Australian courts as the Oscar Schindler of Asia, rather than a homeless criminal that the politicians were hoping. So the show trial somewhat collapsed and turned into one of great respect for this man. But anyway, I proceeded with working at a film, and we would meet every week or so, and we would talk for several hours, and I would take everything he said, and we would then have lunch, and often he'd loosen up and we'd get much more interesting material. And I'd take it home and I'd transcribe it, which would take hours of boring, boring work. But I felt that this was a way of really getting inside Ali, because he had come from a culture where there was no trust. Here was I, a white Western woman, wanting him to open up his life and tell me his story. And he was an Arabic Muslim man, so there was a great gulf between, as you would imagine. He was born in the 1970s, in 1970. So for the first 10 years of his life, he lived under the early years of Saddam Hussein. Those years were initially not unlike Hitler. Saddam was very popular. He managed to keep the money from oil in the country. He put it into free health, free education, universities, infrastructure, buildings, giving back land to people who previously had it taken from them. He was quite popular. What they didn't know, the people generally didn't know, was underneath, he was building a massive army and a very powerful secret police. So at the time it got to the end of the 70s, he used a very clever method. Sitting at your breakfast table in the morning, you didn't know who you could trust. Because if someone was in a family speaking out against the regime or Saddam, the secret police would take one of your brothers aside and say, if you don't inform on your brother, sister, whoever it was, we will take your children and torture them and execute them in front of you. We can't imagine a Sophie's choice like that from a country like this, perhaps. But we could also, I suspect, understand why your brother would betray you. So once you break down that unit, the family unit, the trust within the unit, how can people unite just because they've got a political purpose that they agree on. So it divided society and broke down any capacity for people to stand against him. So I just describe that a little bit as it's the background of this man that I'm working with. I began to realise that I found him so interesting. I wanted to know what drove him, where he came from, who he was, what made him into this man that every day would get knocked down and the next day he would stand up. A man that stayed alive when so many others died. Where he came from, who his parents were, what the background was. And I knew I couldn't do this in a film, an hour and a half film, and this is a 360-page book. And I knew when you do a character-driven film, you just have a very simple plot. Well, this was not a simple plot. This was an epic. It was like an odyssey. It crosses 6 countries, 2 continents, mountain ranges, ships at sea, casts of thousands. So it seemed to me I had to make this choice. Where would I go with it? And I decided if I went with a book, I could get into the underneath of the man and tell the epic journey. And I think the beginning of Ali's task for me was when I, in order to do the book, I needed to get him to agree that we would do a book rather than a film. And when I read him that first chapter, I think he realised that I was not going to manipulate his material. I was not going to Hollywoodise it and romanticise it. I was going to tell it in the raw, real way that it was. And from then on, Cuss grew, and he let me get closer and closer and more intimate. And indeed, the book does go into every aspect of his life. There are 2 love stories. There are all kinds of experiences that he allowed me to explore. At times, I felt I was like his therapist. It was really kind of getting inside the man. And it wasn't easy. How many people in the audience have actually read the book? So I'm not telling everybody. Forgive me that you will hear things that you already know. But this is the majority of people haven't read it. And I've lost my way saying that. I did a very unusual thing with it also. I decided, and I think we both decided, I know what I was saying, it was actually a very difficult journey at times because we had to go to very painful places. And one of the ways Ali had survived, I began to realise, was his father had taught him, and he had taken on quite seriously, you never look back. Every day you look forward to how you're going to solve the next problem. Well, once I got started exploring his life, I was making him look back every day of his life, and it took 3 years for us to write this book. And so near the end it did get very hard for both of us. But what we felt was the book could become an every refugee man story. And, I think as my father, who was in the Second World War, when he returned, he did not want to talk about the horrors he had been through. I think so many refugees who come here don't want to talk about what they've been through. They've come for a new life. They want to try and move forward. But they also wanted to know what they've been through. They want us to know what it was like and why they left their home and their families and their language and their food and their culture and their ancestry and why they got on a leaky boat risking their lives and came here. They want us to understand that, but they don't want to have to talk about it to everybody. And so we thought that, if Ali could tell the story and if I could get to the real depths of it, that he... somehow it would be an everyman story, that other refugees would feel they don't have to do it. And indeed that does seem to be happening. But one of the ways I felt was important to make people really have the experience he was having was to do it in the first person, which is actually an unusual thing to do because a biography is normally written in the third person where you stand back and you observe that person's life. You know, he came into the room full of 120 people and he got a fright and ran out. Rather than I walked into the room and there were 100 people and I said, when you're inside the person, you tend to identify with the experience more. So I wrote it in the first person. A memoir is written in the first person, but it's written by the person who saw it. And it's not a fiction because it's a true story, so it does have difficulty in being classified. But as we go, I want to read little bits to you to give you a feel of the book and... I just wanted to explain that to you first so you know what's going on when I start talking about I. If anyone does have questions as we go, I'm really happy to if you want to put up your hands, and then we'll have a Q&A after. But often one forgets what one wanted to ask by the time the Q&A comes. I'm just going to read you a couple of paragraphs from the first chapter. It's called Hasan Pilot, which is Ali's father's name. I'm just going to do a very short little bit. My father had a reputation as an individual. He was the son of Pilot. Not that the pilot flew planes, on the contrary. But one night, when my grandfather was particularly drunk, he stood on the roof and said, "They think I can't fly? I fly." And he jumped off and broke half the bones in his body. It became a story amongst the people of our city, who named my grandfather Pilot. So my father, Hasan, became known as Hasan Pilot. My grandfather walked with difficulty on two crutches for the rest of his life. But like my father, in those early years, he remained jovial and good-humoured. When he was on his deathbed, Hasan Pilot took me to see the dying pilot, but I was only six and was confused by his sickly smell and the sucking in and out of breath, and I ran from the room. I did not yet know about death. For the first 10 years of Ali's life, his father was a really beautiful father. He was a lovely man, and the children were all incredibly close to him. And then at the age of 10, Ali's father gets picked up by the SS, or the secret police, and thrown into jail and tortured so horrendously for being heard to speak out that he was completely broken as a man. And when ultimately he came back to the family, he was like physically and mentally decimated. He took up drinking and became quite violent with the family. So the children had to get used to this father, who had been a really loving father that used to tell them stories and take them places and things that other children in their community never did, like go to movies, took the daughter to movies. And suddenly he was a very violent father that they were afraid of and had to escape. He was not capable of taking over his role as head of the family, so Ali, as the oldest son, had to fill that role at 10. He would go to school in the morning, and in the afternoon he would go to the markets and sell cigarettes to make money to feed the family. About that time, about 3 or 4 months after the father had got back from his torture experience, he was then sent to fight in the Iran-Iraq War, which you might remember was for most of the 80s. He was sent as a commando. These are the guys that go up front and meet the enemy face to face, and when they take the territory, the army moves in behind and holds the territory, and then they move on. There's a couple of seats here, and there's a lot of seats down the front, so please sit down. But the one thing that father did do was he would come home on leave and he would produce more babies. Maybe a good thing, maybe not a good thing, but it did increase the size of the family considerably. But I mention it because Ali began to be old enough to be father to his children. So I began to sort of understand and see these incredible paternal feelings he had towards his siblings, because basically he raised them. So I think it was sort of like a double thing, you know, my sister, my brother, my daughter, my son. And that continues through his life to this day, this amazing devotion. And also as the head of the family, he did ultimately play the father role. And from the age of 10, you know, this little boy, how he took on those responsibilities, I don't know, but he seemed to do it very gracefully. So father's at war because all of the men were thrown into the army and had to go to war. So father's off at war, and for 8 years he finally comes back. Then 3 years after he's come back, of course we have Kuwait. And when the Americans, you probably all remember, the Americans invaded Kuwait, Iraqis invaded Kuwait and the Americans threw them out. When they came out, they thought that they had, that they could topple Saddam, who's ready to come down. But obviously they couldn't just go in and assassinate him because they'd been supplying arms to Iraq all that time while they were fighting Iran. So in a sense they were a friend of Saddam Hussein. So they asked the Shiites in the south. All of the Shiites basically were living in the south, the major population in the south. Saddam himself was a Sunni, and the Sunnis were a minority, but he held power by this fist of steel with his army and his secret police. So the Americans said to the Shiite, "If you rise up, we will support you." And so the Shiites did rise up, and then for reasons none of us really understand, the Americans went home. So the Shiites were left with no air power, and Saddam brought his army in and went right through the south and took out all the men and boys of fighting age and threw them into Abu Ghraib. I'm just going to read you another little snippet. They're following on from that. They moved swiftly through the mostly Shiite southern cities, imprisoning, torturing and killing all the young men and anyone suspicious. When we heard Saddam's army was coming, everyone ran out of the city. It made no sense because there was nowhere to hide, but our options were fight or flight, and we knew we could not fight AK-47s, so we flew. There were 11 of us by then, 9 children plus my parents, but my father refused to go. Perhaps by now he and Saddam were as mad as each other. But he yelled, "I won't run from Saddam. He destroyed our country. He should be running from us," and stood firm. There was no moving Qassam Pilot once he had made up his mind, or perhaps he knew there was a limit to how long he could go without a drink. But either way, we had to give up and flee without him. My mother's last baby, Hashim, was only 1. I was carrying him in my arms as we ran through the streets. When we were about a kilometre from the city, we saw a helicopter. Maybe some of the remaining Americans were coming to save us after all. But when it got close to us, we could see it was one of Saddam's, and then it began shooting at us. We scattered and ran towards a cluster of date palms. I clutched the baby to me and tried to cave my body around him as I ran, while the helicopter circled and dived on us, spraying bullets. I leapt beneath some of the low fronds with the baby. Ahmad was already there, trying to shield our little sisters, Afra, Alam and Ines. My mother clutched my other brothers. Ahmad and I caught each other's eyes. This had to be the end. The palms were virtually no cover. With guns blazing, the helicopter circled again and began its final approach. All the children were crying by now, and baby Hashim, sensing his siblings' fear, screamed hysterically. I held his tiny body tightly to me and looked again at Ahmad. He was shaking with terror, yet he tried to smile at me. "It's okay, at least we go together," he whispered. Overhead, the roar of the helicopter and the guns got louder, but then the firing ceased. I looked up to see the belly of the helicopter, but to the left of it was a passing American plane. The shooters had pulled in their guns and the helicopter was backing off. Within minutes it had disappeared and the US plane continued on its way. Maybe it was just heading home to the USA, but one way or other, it inadvertently saved our lives. God bless America. Ali and his brother and his father were all picked up and thrown into Abu Ghraib. They were separated, and Ali lived in a cell that I imagine was probably not much bigger than twice the size of this stage, out to the chairs, back to the window. At night, 26 of them could sleep if they lay down like spoons or jammed up together in a sardine tin, but 4 of them still had to stand up in the alcove at the doorway. In the morning, the 26 stood up and the 4 lay down and slept. During their days, they waited to hear the jackboots coming down the corridor and the iron door to open, and the guards would step in and call names. And whoever's name was called, they would be taken to torture that day. And if you survived torture and were thrown back into jail, you would. There was no fresh water and no disinfectant, so many people died from their injuries. Many were tortured and executed after. Many were tortured to death, and some were just executed. Every day there were arbitrary executions in that jail. Maybe just to make room for more people. We don't know, because they certainly didn't know why they were being executed. I couldn't have lasted half a day with that kind of fear, not knowing when it was going to happen and if it was going to be you. They couldn't even talk to each other about their families and the worry they were having about what was happening to the people they left behind, because they had no communications outside. Because they all knew that they all had their limits under torture, and eventually they may speak. And they didn't want to have information that they disclosed about the other people in the cell with them, who had become their friends. Ali lasted for 4 years, which I find extraordinary. I have written in quite detail about being inside Abu Ghraib at that time. We know a lot about what it was like, even what it looked like when the Americans were torturing the Iraqis. with electric shock and stuff, which was hideous. But under Abu Ghraib, it was known as the worst jail in history. Ali used to say to me, anything you can imagine or that I can tell you, worse was done. Anyway, he managed, being Ali, to survive. It wasn't all, strangely, it wasn't all gloom and doom. He had a lot of stories to tell, you know, about the way they made fun in those horrible conditions, and the strength of the human spirit I found so extraordinary that I just had to write about it, because I felt that nobody had quite gone there before. I haven't read it particularly in the first person. But if you do read the book and you find the second chapter difficult, you can skip over it. But I also tried not to focus on the actual physical violence, but more on what Ali was feeling about his circumstances and what was happening in his head. In 1991, that was, Ali gets out and he goes back and tries to rebuild his own life in the south, in this little town called Divinia. One of the things I really loved about Ali, and I still love about Ali, is that he didn't blame. You know, I think we're a little bit of a culture of blame. We see this with our politicians at the moment. Every boat that sinks and every boat that comes here, every time their border protection policy fails, it's the people's smuggler's fault. We'll revisit that a little later. But this idea of blame, I found it very refreshing that he didn't. He didn't want to hunt down the people that had tortured him, for example. However, he did want to bring Saddam down. So eventually he goes to the north, being Kurdistan, which is which was made a safe haven by the United Nations. So if anyone wanted to join the resistance, we'd go to the north. The only trouble was the penalty of going to the north and joining the resistance, if you were caught, was death. You were shot if they found out that you were there, or if you came back and they found out you had been there. But the other problem with the resistance was, because I used to think, why don't they just shoot this guy? I mean, if his whole family's been taken from you, shot, tortured, put in jail or whatever, wouldn't you give up your life to try and assassinate him? But the problem was, what I described to you earlier about the trust, when I was talking about Ali trusting me to write his story. If you can't trust your own family, you can't possibly trust people just because you've got the same political imperative. And to go and try and assassinate Saddam Hussein would mean needing to have a huge amount of backup with informants and people getting information and people backing you up and getting you into the right places at the right time. And that was very difficult for them to do when they couldn't trust each other. I was trying to get in that door. So he didn't last. Oh, she's coming out the door. It's okay. Welcome. He spent several years doing amazing work there, which I won't tell you about because it's all quite fascinating, what he actually did. But eventually he realised his family were in danger and had to smuggle them into the north. And of course, the north was Kurdistan, where the Kurds were desperately poor, with no employment. They couldn't help the Iraqis that were coming there to escape. So they were put into refugee camps. They had a very difficult time trying to stay alive. But ultimately, they're in a little town called Erbil, and Saddam breaks the treaty and invades Kurdistan. And so they hear the tanks coming and the army approaching, and they run to a town called Selmayr, which is right on the border of Iran and Iraq. And Ali had tried to get across every other border and been unsuccessful. So he decided that they would run to Selmayr and try and get across the Iran-Iraq border. They didn't want to go into Iran. Many of their family had died during that terrible war in the 80s. So they get to Selmayr, and he finds a smuggler. And one problem with getting into Iran across that border is it's a massive mountain with ice and snow and shaggy cliffs that have to be climbed around us. It's an enormously dangerous crossing. And Ali has all his little children and his mother, who's not well, and he has to get across. He gets a smuggler who finally agrees to do it for the small amount of money they have. And he goes off to arrange it. The family waits for him to come back and pick them up. And they start hearing the windows flying open in the houses nearby. People hanging out calling, Saddam's army is coming to Selmayr, Saddam is on his way, the army is coming, and they start calling out of the houses. And then they hear, Chemical Ali is coming, Chemical Ali is coming. I don't know if you'll remember when Chemical Ali gas bombed Kurdistan, and on the television we saw these terrible pictures of dead women lying over their babies and people with their shopping dying in the street. 7,000 people in one village in just moments were killed with gas. So the Kurds are absolutely terrified. So they all start pouring out of houses, and where I am in Melbourne, maybe the size of Ararat, Bendigo, size town. Everybody pouring out, and the town becomes a ghost town in a matter of hours, just to show you how afraid these people were and heading for the border. Ali's smuggler comes back and says, you don't need me. Gave his money back. He's joined the exodus. I just want to read you a moment of this exodus. Heads across Kurdistan and eventually gets to the border. Are we enjoying reading, so is it better I talk? If you're not. When we arrive at the border, we are daunted by what we see. Thousands of people are already here, with the Iranian army and secret police standing and watching at the gate, not letting people in. We stand separately, and after a long wait, the gates open, and the officer in charge comes through in a jeep. He cruises slowly amongst the people, discussing individual groups with his officers. When the jeep reaches us, the officer looks at my mother in her Arabic clothes, surrounded by five children. Who are these people? He asks his cohort. I have been standing talking with an Iraqi guy while we wait. His name is Wahid, and he speaks in Farsi to interpret for me. He nudges me and whispers, "Stand back. If they see you see just a woman with children, they will be sympathetic. If they see you are with them, they won't let you in." There is no way of knowing if Wahid is right or not, but in that split second, I have to make a choice. I don't want to be separated from them, but neither do I want to cripple their chances, so I step away. "They don't seem to belong to anyone, sir," the officer's deputy says. "They're just a family." The officer beckons my mother to come forward. She glances around for me, and I try to indicate with the smallest gesture that she should do what he says without me. Trusting that I am right, she gathers her strength and approaches the officer cautiously. Through an interpreter, he asks, "Who are you?" She is about to look around to me again for help, but realizes just in time not to. One thing you can trust about my mother is that the survival of her children will always come first. If I am there, she defers to me, but without me, she is still capable of being a powerful force. She looks the officer in the face and turns on her charm. "We are Shiite Iraqis. We are running away from Saddam. He had my husband and two sons in his prisons and murdered another. We ran to the north and now Saddam bombs the north. We want to come to Iran, where there is safety for us. We just want to find peace." The officer looks at her longer than he needs to, then says, "Do you belong to any party?" "No," my mother says quickly. He turns to his deputy. "Okay, let them come in." My mother hurries towards the gates, her eyes fixed on front of her, her arms around the children. I know she is telling them not to look back, but little Hashem can't help himself. He turns to see me one more time and stumbles. Afra, my sister, grasps his hand to stop him falling, but as she does, she catches my eye for a second and I can see hers are full of tears. I want to call out that everything will be all right, but instead I have to look away as if I don't even know them. "You did the right thing," Wahid whispers, and he is probably right, but if I never see them again, this moment will haunt me for the rest of my life. Ali bin Ali crosses the mountains. Oh, gosh. Okay, how can I truncate this? Crosses the mountains after three times crossing the mountains, and he eventually gets across. The book is starting to sound a bit grim, but in fact it's very humorous how he finally does get into Iran. And in this massive country, he finds his family. After a couple of years of relative peace, they realise that things are changing politically in Iran, and they have to move on. And all the Iraqis that are there are moving out. And at that point, they hear about Australia. They hear it is a democracy. They hear that it is a compassionate country, that the people are welcoming. But more importantly, they hear that it is a signatory to the United Nations Convention for Refugees. And they hear that this means that they can go by any means to Australia and apply for asylum if they are escaping persecution in their own country. And they also discover that there's a place called the United Nations that they can go to, which you can apply to, and that they will help you get there, and that this is the right way to do it. So they apply, and they wait. There's no UN, of course, in Iran or Iraq or anywhere near them, but they have to send all their papers to Pakistan, and they're waiting, and after 9 months, they get the form letter that says not one of your family qualify for being persecuted, and therefore you, none of you qualify to be refugees. So they are now still stateless in a country they have to leave. Usually what happens is the male goes first and then applies to bring the family to follow, they know this. So Ali decides to go first. They have no money, because as most people that escape from persecution, they don't have time to sell their house or get their final pay or get money out of a bank. They're on the run or they're coming out of prison. So most people have no money. Ali borrows the money to get a false passport, because most people have no passports for the same reason. When you're on the run, you don't stop at an embassy and say, I'd like to get a passport and a visa to Australia, because they want to shoot you. So they usually don't have papers. To get a cheap passport, the best way to get a cheap false passport is just to change the photograph, and then you take on the identity of that person. We do hear our leaders saying, and it's said in the press all the time, people that throw their passports overboard are not the kind of people we want in this country. But if you're travelling on one of those passports, which probably 98% of the people on boats are travelling with, if you can get out of Iraq, because they want to get rid of you, you can get through Malaysia and Indonesia, because their whole economy functions on bribes, so you can pay bribes to customs as you go through. But when you get to Australia, we tend not to take bribes, and we tend to have much better technology to identify false passports. And if you're travelling on a false passport, that's a crime against international law. So, and if you're a criminal, you get sent back to where you came from. So you have to think that maybe rather than these people being the ones we don't want here, they may well be the ones we do want here, because they're a little smarter than the ones that arrived with their false passports. So Ali gets his false passport, and he gets to Indonesia, but Ali himself gets betrayed by people smuggler. He's paid ahead of time for his smuggler, gets to the beach, and he gets left on the beach, and he finds out that the people are paying extra again on the boat, and 50 of them get left behind. He doesn't know what's happened to his family, he's got no prospects of where to go, he doesn't know what to do, he's in a terrible situation. He gets offered, if he works on a boat with a people smuggler, they will put one of his family on each boat for free. And they will pay him enough to fly his family from around to Indonesia. And this is a way out for him. It seems like a no-brainer, except he discovers that this guy's an absolute rogue. And as in every industry, we have the spectrum, the same as what's happening with the health services in at the moment. At the top, you have someone that's doing it for greed and all of their own personal investment, and at the other end, you have people that really genuinely want to work for the betterment of their work fellows. And in between, you have all the shades of grey. It's the same with people smuggling. It's just another business. It was not illegal in Indonesia when Ali was smuggling. It was not illegal until 2010. It was just another business. You were not committing a crime. So most of the people that were people smuggling, or so-called people smuggling, who were helping people get on boats, were other refugees like Ali, who get to Indonesia, one of the poorest, most underemployable country in the world, where people are desperately hungry and poor. You can't get a job to earn the money you need to pay a smuggler to go. You probably don't have enough money to feed yourself. You get a job with a people smuggler. About half, the middle section of the book is all about what it is actually like to people smuggle. I think most of us imagine that we stand at the boat and people line up and we take their money and they get on and they go. It's actually extraordinarily complex, because people are coming in all sorts of little groups. There'll be three people and then 20 people and then five people. How do you know what size boat you're going to get? So you have to get the people before you get the boat. But once you've got the people, they want to go quickly, so then you've got to get a boat. And then more people might come while you're getting the boat. And you've got to get food for the boat, and you've got to get a captain for the boat, and you've got to get a crew for the boat. And then most of the money that you gather, a large percentage of it, goes to the authorities, because you have to pay the Navy and the local police and the national police and the harbour authority. They all have to be paid off in order to get a boat out. And these boats too often cost, you know, $20,000-$40,000 in his time. That's what, you know, they were paying. But Ali only needs enough. He is doing it. He's at this end of the spectrum. His purpose is to get his family out and put his own family on his own boats rather than his row, who he started working for. And Ali charges everyone $1,000, and he puts children on for free, and he puts as many women on for free as he possibly can. And when someone comes over $3,000, he tries to shuffle that money over to the people that have less than $1,000. And you know, if he has 100 people, that's $100,000. So maybe a third of that goes to the local police, and then there's the food, and then there's buying the boat, and eventually, usually, he's used it all up. But the really nice thing I liked about him, and he said he didn't know other people that did this, but this was the way he wanted to be because he didn't want to change himself in order to do what he was doing. He felt what he was doing was a job for people. And if they paid him and he didn't do the job, he gave the money back. So he was constantly in the situation of the police catching a large number of the people on the boat and putting them in jail, and him having to bribe the police to get them out, or having to leave them behind because he couldn't get them out. So he'd give them the money back. So there was always this juggle. At the end of sending a boat, usually there'd be nothing left, so he'd have to start all over again. But little bit drip by drip, he got his family out. Ultimately, because I've got to stop here, he got betrayed. Are you sure? Is everyone getting exhausted? Okay. You wave your hands and you get exhausted. Maybe it's a good time for me to pass the word. He got betrayed, but the thing is, the Australian Federal Police were up in Indonesia, as we all know, trying to catch the so-called people smugglers. I have to just throw in here, the only real people smugglers, the only one that's actually making any money, were the guys at the top. We're never going to catch them, because they're in government, they're in the Navy, they're in big business. You never see them. And the Indonesians don't want them to get caught, because he's bringing money. The whole business of people smuggling, we shouldn't probably call it this way, people coming through the country, brings money in, and their economy is desperate for a turnover of money. So people come in, and even if they're desperately poor, they're buying food, they're having to pay something for a hotel bill, even if they put six in a room, they still have to put money into the economy. It turns things around. We keep hearing from our government that they're making a deal with the Indonesians to make people smuggling illegal, and they're going to help us. Why would they want to help us? I mean, this is part of their economy. They give lip service to us, but as far as they're concerned, you know, it doesn't affect them. It brings a little money in, and these people go. That's why they don't want the boats brought back. Anyway, so Ali was caught leaving the country because he went to another country. He went to Thailand to try and get another job because he finished bringing all his family on. And he got picked up by being betrayed by a double agent who worked for the federal police as well as working as a people smuggler, which is questionable in itself because we, as taxpayers, are actually paying this guy who is the people smuggler. He was a guy that was involved in bringing Civex here. And he betrayed Ali, and Ali was caught and brought to Australia and tried. And in that trial, the government of the day hoped that it would be a show trial because they just brought in a new law that a smuggler's got 5 years for each boat. And Ali had bought 7 boats successfully. I have to add, none of them there was any problem with his boats. They all came very safely. And so he was facing 35 years in jail. They had about 100 witnesses that came, and even though most of those witnesses, in a sense, spoke against him by saying that he was the person that had bought them, the judge eventually acknowledged that he was more of an Oscar Schindler of Asia than a homeless criminal, that he was more a humanitarian and a freedom fighter. And he gave him the absolute minimum jail term of 4 years. And also took off the time he'd already spent in Thailand. He was in Thailand for a couple of years, 9 months. And it's amazing, when I was researching, I went back to Darwin to go through all the trial and to meet all the lawyers. And all of them were going, "Oh, Ali, how are you doing? God, he's a great guy." Even the judge wanted to meet with him. So, I mean, it says a lot about him. I don't think I was wrong in my estimate that he was a really decent man. Is, I don't know what I'm saying was, is a really decent man. The rest of it is all happened here in Australia. When he does his time, he does his 4 years. When he gets out, he thinks, "I've finished. I've done everything now." And he gets out of Darwin jail, And but he thinks now I can apply for permanent residence and live with my family. They've all got permanent residency, they're all citizens now. All the people I've brought here, as far as we know, there's only one who wasn't found to be a legitimate refugee and hasn't now got permanent residency. Now I can start my life again with my family in a safe place. And the immigration department are waiting for him and they say, no, 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 you came here on a criminal visa and now you have no visa at all. So you are, you have no rights here, so we're going to put you in detention. So they put him in detention and he stayed there for 2 years. And that's about where I came in and met these advocates who were doing these continual court cases and stuff to get him out, the lawyers and psychiatrists and journalists and all kinds of people. I guess the thing is, maybe we should actually, that's probably a good point to ask the questions, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about what's happening in Australia now, and I need to give more time for that. So I can go on. I can initiate the questions. I can say things like, whenever I start to talk about refugees to people, they say, yes, but they are queue jumpers. Shall we do that one? He's still in Australia. He lives in what he calls, in Sydney, Rimarangel, because he's on a bridging removal visa, which means any day they can send him back. So he can't start his life again. He can't do a job. He's not even wanting to employ someone that can be sent out and left, sent out of the country, you know. He doesn't want to marry because he wouldn't take a woman with him back to Iraq because it's so dangerous. He'll probably be shot when he's sent back because all the people that he worked against in his existence, they're also there, the artists are still there, they've just got underground. So it's pretty miserable, actually, and we're desperately hoping that enough people will write to the Minister Barnes and say, you know, after reading the book, we think this is a man that should deserve a citizenship. I mean, the irony is, the guy that betrayed him, who I said, you know, worked on his ex, and was a double agent, was actually brought to Australia for free, paid $250,000, given a salary and citizenship to inform on Ali and other people's problems. And Ali, he can't get one, he can't get a visa. Should we go back to queues? I don't know how many people believe in the queue jumping thing. I mean, there's all these refrains that I heard today twice. Just grabbing bits of the News 24, I saw both two of our major leaders call these people, these both people, illegal. And when we have this language coming from our leaders, I mean, we have to believe our leaders are sufficiently educated and informed that they know what is what. I mean, if we can't believe that, what are we believing? And then, unfortunately, the press pick it up and reprint it without comment. These words are perpetrated all the time, the illegalness. Now, as I said, they have a legal right under international law to come here. So what are we doing calling them illegal immigrants? Both words don't apply. The queue, and please anyone who is in the audience has more information than me, stop me on this, but my understanding is this. We have three categories. One category is people that come here as immigrants. They go through the normal process to immigrate to Australia. They're usually people from maybe UK or countries like that where they have children here or grown-up children or family or they have an illness and want the better weather or they... you know, the ones that lifestyle or whatever, or they have a terrific skill that we really need here, like, you know, judges and lawyers and engineers or whatever. And we take at least 180,000. Someone told me the other day it's 200,000. Does anyone know that? Well, today it's only 180,000. Interestingly, we seem to have no problem with that. So when we talk about, or hear people talking about, how the country's going to be overrun if we let all these boat people in, you could make that comment. We already take 180,000 each year. We then have the UN quota, which currently takes 6,500. Those people, that's quarantine just for people out of the UN camps. But we go, our representatives go overseas to the various camps and pick out people that we want. So they might pick your brother who has the right... language skills and social skills and physical skills or whatever. and you will get the job, but you mightn't, because you may not have been as well educated, or you may have different things, or you may have a disability, which is not a good thing to have to get in here. So we actually go and pick those people. But anyone coming here by boat can't knock those people off, because the quota is just for people from the UN, UN camps. It is not for boat people. So, and usually people are talking about queue jumpers, say, well, they're queue jumpers because they're jumping the queue on the people that are in UN camps who have to wait forever. Well, they do have to wait forever. And the truth is that certainly at this time, 98% will never get resettled. About 2%, and even if you take that up to 5%, let's say it's 5%, will ever get resettled. So the rest of them are going to spend their lives on those dirt floors watching their little kids grow up to big kids with no education, no stimulation, nothing. Often not enough food. So, you know, a large number of people on the boats are actually people out of those camps who have given up and said, I've waited for 8 years, I'm not going to do it anymore. And unfortunately, there's nothing to do in those camps, so they have a lot of children. So these children are growing up so disadvantaged and dysfunctional that, of course, you go and catch a boat. So that's that category. So the people who come on boat are not knocking them off. And there's one more category, which is the humanitarian category. And that's what takes the intake of boats. And they take a whole bunch of things. They take women at risk, so women in countries with war-torn countries that are likely to be killed for who they are, and, family reunion, refugees who are already here who want to bring their families here. And there are several other categories that go into that. And that's the category that's been increased from 13,500 to 20,000. However, only 6,000 of that is allocated to Indonesia. The rest of the camps, I don't know why they would do that, because there's only, as far as we know, there's only 7,000 in the camps in Indonesia, and there's probably three that are on the run that the police haven't caught yet. But if you made it 10,000 and took 10,000 out of it, you would clear Indonesia. And then we have, if I make sense, or if I talk too fast about the queues? So there is no queue. I mean, apart from anything else, even if there was a queue associated with these UN camps, there's hundreds of these camps. What would happen? You've got somebody that's ready for resettlement in Australia. Do you ring up the other 100 camps and go, my guy's got to the front, who's second? You know, how would you do that? How would you coordinate to work out who's first? So the queue thing is a ridiculous argument. More arguments. Yes?
Okay, I'll speak without the mic. I just wonder, as a filmmaker, whether you do have any aspirations to have this story made into a film? So that's the first qualified question. And the second is, I wonder whether you care to comment on the way people smugglers are portrayed in the media about the Four Corners program several months ago, featuring Safeway car park scene with Captain Emad and Sarah Ferguson's attempt to chase him down. And what
would
you
read
about that kind of filmmaking?
Firstly, making this into a film, as I said, I did begin to write it as a film, so I will, once I've finished the speaking tour, which seems to be going on indefinitely, I'll start writing the script. And I'm not sure whether it might be better served as a miniseries, because it's like three natural sections, and that way I could get all the book in. If I make it as a film, I'll have to cut a lot of it out. So definitely that's what's next. As regards the Four Corners program, have we got any friends of Four Corners in the room that I've got to be careful of? I don't want to speak against a colleague, but I have big concerns about that project, about that particular episode of Four Corners, and I think it did a huge amount of damage. I mean, first of all, the idea of the thing that was so frightening, the idea of smugglers in our midst, is really, there's something quite absurd about it. I mean, how can you be a smuggler in your country of destination? To be a smuggler, you buy the boat, you get the captain, you put the people on the boat. And once they go to sea, well, you know, you've got nothing more to do with it. You can make phone calls from Australia. But the Captain Emad, as far as we can understand, certainly most of the people that are in the so-called business, see the Captain Emad as similar to the guy that I call the weasel in my book. Who is the guy that betrayed Ali. In other words, he is in the pay of the Australian Federal Police, and I have no right to claim this. I don't quite, oh my God, I'm being recorded. We might cut this bit out. And so he was presumably an informant and had informed on much of what was happening in Indonesia, and his payoff time came, so he gets flown to Australia and paid and given a house and given a job and told to keep his head down. And Sarah did a very good job of finding him, but it was not, as far as we know, he certainly wasn't being a smuggler in Australia, and probably never was up there, but he was probably an informant. And I think what really justified that was what was happening was that they couldn't, that little ball had been exposed, that he was caught and thrown into court the next day, and they managed to get him out of Australia in extremely unauthentic ways and lost, disappeared to us all before he could take him to court, because if he did get caught or taken into court, he would have had to reveal what he was doing and his relationship with the Australian Federal Police, and I really shouldn't say any more on film. But I think they did a terrible disservice and to the whole issue of asylum seekers, because it's this feeding, constantly feeding this fear. And I don't know what it is that we are so afraid of. Because, for example, in Ali's day, about 2,000 people a year were coming here. But 98% were flying here. But never did I ever see a headline saying asylum seekers with a photo of them getting off a plane. None of us seem to care about that. So when we're talking about we're going to be invaded, well, we've got these categories of the 180,000 that are invading us anyway. Now, they might be nicer people or something. Maybe there's that. I don't know why we've got this incredible prejudice against why people have come on boats. We all came on boats. Is that why we're so scared of them? Saying we're scared of ourselves? I don't understand what it is. And this thing about people paying $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to get on a plane, but people sign to get on a boat, it's just rubbish. If you have even $5,000, or let's say $10,000, you would get a very good passport. You can get a beautiful passport for $3,000, $5,000. And you would buy a ticket to Australia and buy a beautiful suit and a briefcase, and you would come that way. And you would get a visa for education purposes or for a visitor's visa. And as soon as you get through customs in your beautiful suit, you say, I'd like to apply for asylum. Now, that is how the majority of people come to Australia. But Australians don't mind these people at all. Is it because they've got beautiful suits, or is it because we don't photograph them? I don't know. But the few other people come on boats, we get absolutely hysterical about. And I think this is very convenient for the government. Because at the moment, it's the biggest electoral issue facing us. Whoever wins this battle of who can be toughest on refugees will probably win the election. It's just extraordinary. I mean, we could fit, even the number of people that came this year, if they all, that's the biggest we've had for 10 years probably, if we all stood like this, they could fit in this room. Isn't it hysterical? It's unbelievable. So all I can think is, if they continue to use this issue to make us really scared and frightened and have something to argue about, we won't notice if they put the price of petrol up or whatever happens, They won't notice if there are other things that are going through Parliament that we actually are concerned about and would normally argue about. Remember when petrol was 80 cents and we all went crazy and it was in the headlines every single day? It's $1.50 in Sydney now. I never hear anyone squeak about it because it's not important, because we're all talking about voting people. It's just extraordinary. So I don't know what it is with us or what's going on, but at the moment, I really feel for us as a people. Already, we've been seen overseas as a cruel people. And I think people don't really understand what's happening. Think of it this way. If you are going to set up a deterrent, the deterrent has to be worse than what people are running from. So read this book, What Ali's Running From, and then imagine how we as a people can manufacture something worse than that, so they will say, I have to go home because I prefer to be there than in this place because it's so bad, or kill themselves, which is a lot of what they're trying to do at the moment. Four people have tried suicide. Four people. And 355 on a hunger strike, two of which are still hunger striking and are so damaged now, their organs are probably, or how your organs corrupt in the end if you start breaking up, if you hunger strike for too long, so they'll never recover. Once all these... does everyone understand what is actually happening? Well, what we're saying is, what we're going to do to stop the boats Now, I don't understand this, because the boats are still, they're coming more than they've ever come. What we do to stop the boats is we will punish you, and we'll punish you by putting you on these dreadful islands, and you will stay there for as long as it would take to get processed by the UN. That's your punishment. That way we'll stop you coming here. But most people are in the UN camps for most of their lives. So are we going to keep building up? I mean, already that both the islands are almost accounted for in terms of how many people they can take. So are we going to put, like over the last 10 years, I think 25,000 people have come here. Are we going to put 25,000 people on this tiny little island and keep them there and pay for them? I heard the statistics, or I read it in the Sydney Morning Herald, could be the Rail's sister, wrote that it cost us $1 million per man per year to keep them on Nauru during the Pacific Solution, the first Pacific Solution. Think about it. Now, that might sound like an exaggeration, but it costs like $250,000 probably to keep someone in the jail here. So add to that, taking even water has to be taken to these islands. Plus, most of these people are going to come off these islands extremely ill, with dengue fever, malaria, malnutrition, all of no exercise, heat stroke. They're going to be mentally deranged after a few months. Already they're saying they are, and the Amnesty were there, you know, the last few days. So for the rest of their lives, most of them will qualify as refugees. We, as taxpayers, will have to support them on medical benefits. You know, are we happy with that? I think we've got to sort of look, if we're not, if people aren't being appealed to on a humanitarian level, we've got to present the economic level. I mean, we could already have paid off the Gonski report. We could have it implemented by now for what we've spent in the last few years on and what we're going to spend. And you know, the other thing about, we saw all our politicians crying in Parliament when they were saying we can't have any more drownings at sea. The truth is, the majority of boats, in fact, it's believed that it's 97% of the boats come here safely and in orderly fashion. We know where they're coming, we just have to meet them if we don't want any more fatalities. 3% are the ones that, like Christmas Island and the two boats. It's 3% that actually found us. But Christmas Island is a really good example because here we are, we've got this thing, I read in Tony Kevin's book that it cost $16 billion to develop the surveillance equipment we have. I'm prepared to be challenged on that, but it's in writing. $16 billion to develop this surveillance equipment. It is so sophisticated. We know when boats are coming there, and we know where they're going. They're trying to get to Christmas Island or Ashmore Reef. Those are the only two places they're trying to get to. So it's not hard to track them. We knew when that boat was coming to Christmas Island. We knew it was on its way. We knew the seas were high. We knew that so well that we towed our own boats. We moved our own boats around into the cover of the harbour. And we stayed there because we were worried that the boat that towed around there would break up and cause debris all around the edges of the harbour. And I didn't want that to happen, so they stayed there, knowing perfectly well that boat was coming and that the seas were really, really high. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had to bring their own boats in. And yet after it founded on the rocks, it took about 3 hours or something, didn't it, to get around and start trying to pick up those people? You know, you have to question, don't you, why such a big thing has been made of these dark drownings at sea, when it's only 3% that drown? And we haven't stopped them coming. They're still crossing the ocean. I mean, if you really wanted to stop them coming by sea, you have to process them before they leave the land, before they cross the sea. And you can't keep crying about them dying at sea, when you keep implementing policies that mean they have to cross the sea before we can impose this punishment on them. So if you put a processing camp on the Indonesian mainland, and you let the Indonesians make their money out of building it for us, and to supplying the food for us, and becoming guards or whatever, and then we put some of those billions of dollars that we're putting into rebuilding Manus and Nauru, to punish these people in, and to keep those people there. We put some of those billions into helping the United Nations start this camp in Java, so that people could be processed there on land without crossing the ocean, and we send the people back that are economic refugees straight away, and the ones that are legitimate refugees, we bring them here by plane or by an Navy boat. I mean, that to me would be, I'm probably being too simplistic here, but I noticed that the Greens are supporting this idea as well. I mean, they're not taking it from me, I'm listening to them. But it does make sense, doesn't it? And now that works. Then you put one in Pakistan right next to Afghanistan, so they don't have to. So it's a myth that people wake up in the morning and say, let's go to Australia because we think it'd be a nicer place to be. Most people are struggling with their lives, want to stay right close to their country. Like Ali wanted to stay as close, tried all the border crossings for them to wait until Saddam was toppled so that they could stay near their country. People don't want to leave their country just because they're poor. They don't want to leave their language and their food and all the things that make home home. And I think, back to the book, I think what this does tend to do is put a human face on something that has been demonized to such an extent that we as a people have become irrational about it. And I noticed that Chris Bowen was saying in his little speech about what we're going to do next, the people smugglers, it was the people smugglers' fault because their lie that all these extra people are coming at the moment, because they're spreading this lie that you will be processed in Australia and you won't be sent offshore. So what do they think? All these sort of little guys that are doing their job up in Indonesia, putting food on a boat or driving a bus to get people to a beach or getting people from the hotel and putting them in the hotel or whatever. All these people are running around saying, now, you know, when you get to Australia, it's okay. You won't be sent to an island. You'll be processed on the beach, but in Australia. They don't know what's going on out there. The people's mothers, the guys that are doing these jobs are just doing these jobs. Today's work. But you don't have to convince people to get on a boat. If you stand still, you'll be surrounded in Indonesia with people that want to get on a boat. And so you don't have to give them lies and stories. But once again, it's just perpetrating this thing of making it sound like, well, it's not our fault. We've come up with a great idea. We're going to punish these people so badly that they'll want to go home. It's the people's mothers, because they're the people that's telling them it's okay to come to Australia. They're not telling them anything. Half of them are a bunch of uneducated people that don't care one way or the other. They're just doing a job. So, and in Ali's case, he said, and he's a really educated guy, he said he didn't know what was happening in Australia. When people are running for their lives, they don't think about where they're going. They think about what they're running from. And if what they're running from is certain death, anything is going to be better, as far as they can imagine. But they get here and they find that perhaps it's not. Oh, there must be questions. I can hear you. No, use it. I can hear you.
Okay, cool. You spoke very passionately and eloquently about the need for maybe a more balance, but I thought just for argument's sake to mix things up a bit.
Yes.
I might put forward something that is often handled by former Prime Minister John Howard, a larger immigration program.
I'm not sure what the in-control mantra is, because it just seems to me that it's about education. I think it's about, like, we might agree, but the majority don't, and I think the majority don't simply because they don't get the information. And I think the majority are just reading what's in the press, and what is in the press is what... is a copy. At the moment, the press has been so diminished of experienced journalists, because they're all getting fired because of the economy or whatever, they're basically, you know, young journalists who are just getting the media releases from the press releases from Canberra and putting it in the paper. So we're getting direct line of of what the politicians want us to hear. And they actually don't want to hear us have conversations like this. They don't want people to be reading books like this. And I suppose if we can, each one of us, kind of start talking to somebody else, or each one of us that agree on this, start talking to somebody else and they talk to somebody else, and certainly the book is sort of going into places you would never imagine, because I'm going to places where you would never imagine, then maybe that majority changes. Because I think so long as, this is really just about votes, and so long as people can be taught to be afraid and kept afraid, then this will never change. And this competition for who can be toughest on refugees will just get worse and worse and worse. I mean, what are we going to do for them eventually? We're now talking about putting them into the community on bridging visas, which are the same as the temporary protection visas. And for those of you who don't know, not only is that an absolutely miserable existence to someone because they're not allowed to do anything, but they're not allowed to bring their family here. So what happens, legally? So what has to happen? The only way the families can get here is on boats like the Civex, and that's why the Civex, all but 14 people, of the 350 people, were women and children, because they're desperately trying to get here to the people that are on temporary visas. And that's what we're bringing back in. We're stopping family reunion. So what's going to happen is there's going to be a whole heap more boats coming here across the ocean, and they are going to, you know, we're going to have more drownings, and they're all going to be women and children, because you can't. Why should we expect families to accept being separated like that? I mean, it just, it seems like, I don't know what really. See, that makes you think. What I find really interesting is I'm deliberately talking in all kinds of places. I'm doing the regions and places like that. And I'm finding so much compassion from people, and so many people say, but we didn't know that. You know, we thought, and then they tell you things that you realise justify their fear.
So it's an information problem.
I think it is. I think it is, because where do you ever find people that really want to hurt other people, want to give other people a miserable life and punish them? I don't think there are many people in our society particularly who want to do that. I mean, it's not like we've lived under a terrible regime where we've been threatened with our own lives and stuff. I mean, we've all had reasonably decent lives. I think it's just misinformation. They've been made into the other. They've been made into like the first time we see them, these few thousand people, we see them on the boat. It's always the same footage on the ABC, the same people. They all have headscarves and look daggy and terrible because they've probably been on the run for a year or two with the same clothes. And they get here, and so long as you have a few headscarves, you think, oh, they're all Muslims. Well, the truth is, less than 50% are Muslim. Most of them are Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, but they're not. The majority is not Muslim. And then the next time you see them, they're behind the razor line. But when they're on that boat, at least one, but usually several of our politicians refer to them as illegal immigrants. And then we see them behind the razor line, and we think, okay, well, they must be criminals then. And so they should be there. And that's what the majority of people see, because they've got too much going on in their lives to really explore any further. I do think it's education. And I think, you know, once we start being called cruel people, I think maybe it will affect us the same way as the white Australian policy did. It took us generations to get over that. And somewhere inside, we're going to feel that we belong to a culture that treats the most desperate people in the world in this savage, punitive way. And I think eventually, you know, I think this battle will win.
Could I just make a comment in the sense?
Yes, I'm sorry, you're probably from the press. Not Four Corners,
I want to speak to the diversity from redundancy from the age, so yes. I'm not an editor at the end. One of the things I was proud of was our attitude to the day and age, and I have to learn to say they now, not we, but I was very proud today of today's age of climbing the hill at the back, where they could be seen, and they communicated with the editorial line was always that the government had to fulfil its obligation. The problem is that the audience that sort of is shrinking. In a way, that's probably how do you get to change attitudes to educate people, the educators of the age. If the government just based its policy on that,
Look, it is. I'm really glad you said that, and I think the Age is fantastic. And the Sydney Morning Herald have people like Natalie O'Brien who are wonderful. And I suppose I'm a bit unfair making it a blanket. In the back of my mind is the shock jocks and the commercial channels that sometimes I just fall off my seat for things I hear them say and misinformation that we constantly get. So it's not at all directed to, you know, the Fairfax papers, really. Sorry, we've gone too long. Does everyone have to leave? I guess each of us can only do what we can do.
Yeah.
And if we really don't want to become seen like we were seen when we were under the wider state of policy, we have to feel that is enough to try and find our own way to talk to people And you know, it's so hard because you obviously, you know, people have very strong views about it, and you have to do it in a way that doesn't sound like you're discrediting what they believe. But there is all sorts of information now that you can get that's the truth. And when you see how different it is to what we're being told. You just wish everyone could get it, so talk about it a lot.
Okay, we've got one more question from Spencer in the front, and then I'd like to wrap it up, if that's okay, because
yes,
we will
sorry,
otherwise
sorry.
Run out of time. So we'll just go to Spencer over there. And
hi, Robin. Just one matter of information. I'm aware that quite a large into it by enough people approaching him, or he might one day sort of think it's a decent thing to do and do it. He might be waiting to keep working. But one of the original reasons, of course, to write the book is to try to get to it.
Okay, thank you, Robin. Before formally thanking Robin, I'd just like to comment a little bit on hysteria, blame, where Robin fits in and where the media fits in, just as a wrapping up comment. Robin spoke about blame and hysteria in the context of relatively small arrivals of boat people. And we've had a bit of an evolution in the last couple of decades. So we went from the Howard government, demonising asylum seekers, obviously, but not really focusing so much on the people smugglers. So obviously we had blame for throwing passports into the sea, then we had a moment of supposedly throwing children into the sea, and all of that nasty business. Now, with the election of Kevin Rudd, who will promise a more humane approach to refugee processing, and part of the rhetoric was the demonisation of the people smugglers. So Rudd evokes biblical language, that people smugglers should rot in hell, they're the scum of the earth. So the rhetoric changed, and then we came to the situation this year, which I thought was fascinating, where we had the drownings, the tragic drownings, and the rhetoric changed in Parliament. So all of a sudden, offshore processing, which Labor had castigated in opposition, became cloaked in the mantle of humane policy. This was to save the asylum seekers. We were doing this for them, to save them from themselves. And the image of politicians crying in Parliament, I think a lot of them really believed that this was humane policy and this was what they had to do. And I think that events unfolding in recent days would certainly disabuse anyone, any thinking person, of that illusion that offshore processing is a humane policy. So where does Robin fit in? I think that the way we need to address the problem of blame and the rhetoric that we have with respect to both people or irregular maritime arrivals is by telling the human stories. And I think that Robin has done an incredibly important job in that regard. And the media sometimes does a good job. I think that The Age has played an honourable role in this media landscape. And so has the ABC in some respects, The Drum, for example. I also think it's worth mentioning something like SBS's Go Back to Where You Came From, because that was reality TV, real reality TV, complete with hype, shock jocks, you know, and lots of advertising and a huge audience. But it wasn't manufacturing the drama by saying every housemate's got a secret. It was actually going to Mogadishu and going to Kabul and showing real stories and giving people some understanding of why people are driven to get on boats. So I think that's terribly important, and I think that what Robin has written is terribly important, and I'm sure that the book will win many more prizes, and I'd like you to join me in thanking her for coming and speaking. Interested in purchasing the book or having a chat with Robin, you can do so now. Thank you very much for coming. Have a good night.
That's really good what you said.